We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
My name is Jari Bolander. Welcome to the Entrepreneur Ethos Podcast. On this podcast, we're going to take a deep dive into the traits, values, beliefs, and skills of all sorts of entrepreneurs to learn how to build a more ethical, inclusive, and resilient world. Let's get started. Hey, everyone. Stay tuned to the end of the interview where I'll give you some actionable insights that I learned from my guest. These insights are also in the show notes. As always, thanks for listening. Now, on to my guest for today, Christopher Fox, founder of Synchronous, a communications strategy firm. Chris earned a PhD in French literature, but after 2 years teaching, he realized it wasn't for him. He took his research and communication skills and put them to work into digital communications and strategy, eventually founding his own firm. He's evolved his focus to fintech and particularly to work with thought leaders in this niche, finding that his passion and skills for analyzing the complexity of French literature translates well into peeling back the layers of the complex discourse of fintech. One key factor in getting to really understand a concept, Chris explains, is to understand its context. Chris's main objective when working with clients is to help them connect with or rediscover their why. This not only connects them to their passion, it helps them shape their story for the external world and for their target audience. For his clients and for his own business, Chris focuses more on crafting the message and getting it in front of the right people than on trying to game SEO or algorithms. Tune in also to find out what French books Chris recommends, as well as has insights into why it's easier for people to actually understand credit cards than Bitcoin. Now, let's get better together. Christopher Fox, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. It's really, really great to be on. I really appreciate you having me on today.
Well, I appreciate you coming on. I think we met through matchmaker.fm, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I think that might be right.
Yeah, I love what James is doing over there at Matchmaker. It's a huge benefit to everyone, podcaster and guest, because it's hard to find quality guests like yourself.
Well, yeah, I appreciate it. Hope to prove out that quality in the course of the conversation.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, you've got a really interesting background and doing some really cool stuff in kind of fintech thought leadership, which we will get to in a second, but before we get to that, I would love to hear how you got to do what you're doing today.
Yeah, so it's a great question. So what I'm doing today is I focus on thought leadership strategy and content development exclusively within the world of fintech and financial innovators. And I point that out as the current state because it has absolutely nothing to do and no apparent resemblance to the starting point. I started off my career as an academic. I was teaching French literature at the university level. I'd gotten my doctorate in French and kind of got myself to a point within the academic world after 2 years of realizing this is not for me. This is not what I need to be doing. This is more or less unrewarding and unsatisfying professional environment to work in. And I want to do something different. This was really at the early stages of the dot-com boom. So I realized that I could transition the skills that I had in terms of teaching and research and communication and bring those into the world of digital and internet consulting. So I worked in that area for several years and moved around from between a couple of companies, ultimately, you know, coming up the ranks and becoming a director of user experience and content at a small internet consultancy. And I ultimately realized, well, you know, why do I need to do this for a firm when I have a very strong specialized point of view and a strong set of skills and expertise that I could bring to the market? And I decided to take that entrepreneurial leap. And I've founded Syncrasys, my company, in 2007. It started off as kind of a generalist company, you know, focused on digital communications, communication strategy, content marketing for a range of industries. Over time, I realized that my business would only get better and that my delivery would only get more focused as I really, really narrowed down to a specific industry. So it became, you know, broadly the world of finance, and then even more specifically to that over the past 4 or 5 years, where I've been in this world of financial innovators, whether those be large global banks that have an internal innovation unit and they're doing innovative things out there in the financial markets, or you know, more on the technology side, the fintechs that are developing products and developing services that are, you know, disrupting what's happening or innovating and moving things forward in terms of the way that people are able to conduct transactions and exchange value.
Hmm. Wow. French literature to the internet.
Yeah. French literature, internet, fintech.
I think that's probably the most eclectic path. I can't remember anyone with more of an eclectic path than that, but it's so interesting that, I mean, what got you into French literature to begin with? I mean, especially getting a PhD in it, which, you know, that's difficult and challenging to do.
Yeah. The answer to that question is actually on the path to why these things in a very unexpected way end up tying together, which is, you know, I've always been really fascinated by complex structures. And I've always been really fascinated by trying to figure out how to interpret something that is, you know, on the surface, fairly difficult to get a handle on. And during my undergraduate life, I found that the seminars on French literature were so much more interesting than some of the other subject matters that I was exploring in college. And I decided to major in that. And, you know, you really get to wrestle with such a complex matrix of issues, whether it's the, you know, the formal qualities of the literary work itself, the broader cultural and philosophical context, political context, historical content in which that work sits. There's so many layers and so many dimensions to it that I really, really got engaged in the intellectual challenge of juggling all of those complex issues. The way that it connects to fintech, it's kind of a long set of leaps, but ultimately, you know, every time I work with a new client that's doing something, you know, exceptionally complex in the world of investment management or wealth tech or AI tools that support regulatory and compliance functions, or you know, crypto, or any of these tools, you're really mastering a whole new language and a whole new discourse every single time. Fintech sounds like it's one thing, but when you really look at it, a fintech is this collection of thousands and thousands of very complex niches inside the unbelievably complex animal of the global financial system. And that's where, in a kind of strange, unusual way, there is this analogy between the type of work that I initially entered the professional world doing in terms of, you know, research and analysis around literary texts to what I do today.
Yeah. It's interesting. And because, yeah, I mean, you know, the French language in general, I mean, I've been to France a bunch of times and trying to speak French, I would just get laughed at because I barely speak English at times. But I've always been fascinated with just the French culture in terms of the way it shows up in literature and the way, like, I love French movies because they're sort of dark and they kind of almost always end badly. And I'm like, oh, this is like life, right? I don't know what it is that draws me to these things. It's just so, it's gritty and visceral yet beauty. You know, it's hard to maybe it's just the movies I see, but I mean, I'm just curious. And what would be like a really good book of French literature that people should read to sort of get a grasp of how the complexities of this, or some one that just sort of kind of shows kind of a showcase of how what you're talking about kind of interweaves? Because I agree with you. I mean, language in fintech is, I mean, you have to look no further than like the regulatory stuff to know that.
That's
my
right.
Guess is you got to like unpack, like, what does that word mean? I mean, it's like a puzzle almost.
No, it's really true. And, you know, as I interact with, you know, founders of smaller companies or, you know, senior leadership within larger banks, one of the things they all struggle with is that a lot of times the marketers aren't very good at speaking their language and vice versa. And they need someone who can sit in between them and be that interpreter, speak fluently to marketers to understand what it really takes to get visibility, to generate leads, to pull people through the funnel, but then can turn around to that person who, you know, has an operational role or a product development role or something like that, and also speak to them in their language to understand, you know, the real nuance of what they're building. So there's kind of that translator element. But, you know, to go back to your question of a work on French literature, so would you say that you're looking for something somewhat accessible, or, you know, what I really think is that, you know, the juiciest and meatiest thing to take on?
I would say let's get one of each, just because knowing what I know about a little, I mean, I don't know much, but you sort of got to warm up with this stuff. I think it's sort of, you know, what would you warm up with? And then what would you say, like, oh yeah, this is the one to read.
Yeah. So to take it down even a little bit deeper, my specialty was 19th century French novel. So that's already going to influence what I say. Mm-hmm. I would say in terms of accessibility, you know, a great starter piece would be pretty much any of the novels by either Balzac or Zola. Both of those authors, you know, the novels themselves are relatively accessible. They're plotted out in a, you know, pretty traditional way. You can get through them. You know, some of them get a little bit long, but you can really take them on. And I would say, you know, with Balzac, you could even go for some of his shorter fiction. So I'd say really anything by those two authors would be a great starting point. And if you really, really want to challenge yourself, and you know, you can certainly read it in translation as well. There's some good translations out there. Would be Marcel Proust's Remembrance of Things Past. It is a big, big monster to take on. It's I think it works out to be like 3,500 pages. It's in multiple volumes. Wow. And you go through it. But if you really, really want to see the subtle inner workings of, you know, what I think is a uniquely French approach to literature and all of these different dimensions that I've been talking about, how it intersects with, you know, with aesthetics and philosophy and current events and politics and all these different things, that's the place to go. And, you know, there are people who spend years with that book. That, you know, they read it once, they get so hooked, they go back into it again and again and again. It's one of those lifetime novels.
Wow.
And yeah,
so interesting.
And I guess the other one I'd mention, and kind of sits in between those, would be Flaubert. So, you know, people I think are familiar with Madame Bovary, or you've heard the name. in any case. I mean, that's a great one. Another one would be sentimental education. Sentimental education is a great example of exactly the types of things that I'm talking about.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Well, thank you for that. Well, I mean, what's interesting about like the word entrepreneur comes from the French.
That's true too.
Yeah. And used to mean undertaker or funeral director. So we undertake a business, right?
That's so, right. Yeah.
I think, was it Prendre means to take or to undertake.
Right.
I completely butcher it. But so many of our words that we use, of course, in English come from French and Italian and German and all this and Dutch as well. But I just always find that interesting that the, you know, what we do being an entrepreneur rooted in, you know, the back in France, you know, which is so interesting because it's such a weird word. I have a hard time even pronouncing it sometimes, and more importantly, I have a hard time spelling it. Even though I wrote the book, I still misspell entrepreneur. And what's interesting, you know, and again, I appreciate that on the literature front. I mean, I love to read, and I also think reading literature, novels, fiction, and nonfiction as an entrepreneur, as someone who's creative, opens your mind to the possibilities of, I think, one of the most important things that's lacking in the entrepreneur community. It's something I'm passionate about, and I know it's something you're passionate about. It's how to tell the story about what you do. And through great literature, we can learn how to tell better stories. And I think what you're trying to do with, you know, these fintech thought leaders, and it's super important for a lot of different reasons, which I want to get into. But one of the most important reasons it's important is communication is at the art or the center of our art as entrepreneurs.
That's right.
If we could only do one thing, it would be communicate what the heck we're doing. And so I'm curious, how do you pull, I don't know if they're kicking and screaming, but I'm just going to use the kicking and screaming analogy. How do you pull these CEOs, techie people that are in, I mean, deep dive into fintech. I mean, you know, like down so far down the rabbit hole that literally they use 3-letter acronyms, 4-letter acronyms that are literally like, who knows what the heck they mean? How do you kind of, what's your process to go through them? Because, you know, I think it's so fascinating that, you know, the analysis of French literature popped you into telling better stories about fintech.
Yeah, I mean, and you're really right too. You know, when an entrepreneur gets in and gets deep into what they're doing, that there are a few things that happen. As you were suggesting, first is that they often get lost in their own private language or the private language of a very small niche in the market. You know, everything that's going on right now with this explosion of chatter around non-fungible tokens is a great example of something that is this incredibly private and arcane, and you call it cryptic, if you will, language that people get very good at speaking to themselves and speaking within that community. And it's very, very difficult to cross the line, get through that membrane of the bubble that they're in into the broader market of how people make investments, make purchases, otherwise participate in the global financial system. So that's one piece of it. And also, you know, as a founder, I think you end up just getting really deep into the mechanics of doing your business, right? You've got to go out there and you've got to find investors. You have to ultimately have to build some kind of product. You have to get it out there into the marketplace. All of those challenges are, I don't want to say they're incredibly distracting, but they are incredibly focusing. And they distract you, and that's why I was using that word, from the idea of, oh, right, we actually have to communicate this outwards as well. And the way that I connect with entrepreneurs who are, you know, deep in the trance of creating a product and creating a company is I take them back through their why. You know, every product is ultimately, this is my view of the world, every product is an idea about change. If you turn it inside out, it's not a bundle of features and functionality. It's an idea about change in the world. And that's why an entrepreneur will stand behind it. They're not building these things because they're bored or they have nothing better to do. Deep down there, there is an idea about how some little aspect, in the case of fintech, some little aspect of the way that, that people exchange value in the global financial system could be better. And what I do in working with my clients is I get really, really deep into that why. You know, why are you doing this? Why is that better? Why does that matter? And there are a couple of benefits to it. One is that it starts to bring all of those messages and stories to the surface so that they become more nimble in communicating it outside of their own bubbles. And then the other is there's a kind of an unrelated benefit to the work that I do, but I find, you know, my clients really, really value it, is that it reconnects them to their passion. Because, you know, often as an entrepreneur, as a founder, you're solving a lot of really messy and unpleasant problems on a day-to-day basis. And to have that little space where you can go back into the absolute, you know, the highest level of your why and the passion that you have around the topic, it's a real activator for thought leadership. And the same thing vice versa. Getting close to your positioning and your messaging as a thought leader is an activator or reactivator of that passion that's got you out there sweating and spending so much of your time trying to build this thing in the first place.
Yeah, it's so true. It's so true. I mean, I tell this to people all the time. You hear it in this podcast all the time. I talk about your why. It's the journey. Really, it's the fame, fortune, and prestige. They're all fleeting. You're going to get people that aren't going to like you. You're going to get people that just don't get it. There's going to be so many challenges and struggles along the way that if you really focused on that outer journey, the trappings of success, so to speak, when the going gets tough and all those things go away, you're literally left sitting there with who you are and why you're doing it. And it is interesting that you mentioned, you know, your why and reconnecting back to sort of the bigger focus or the big idea, or, hey, you know, all this toil and trouble for what we think is going to be a revolutionary thing and to help, you know, people transact better. Because, I mean, the global financial, I'm going to call it a monster because it's a monster. And in anyone that's ever looked at any of this or studied any of this, it is super complex. Some of it is completely unfair. It is driven by the more money you have, you end up getting more money. Those at the bottom of the pyramid have got a harder time. The people that really need the money hardly ever get the money. You know, it's a huge ballast to overcome, so to speak, to get these new thoughts, this, you know, Bitcoin and crypto and, you know, NFTs. I'm glad you brought that up because I still don't understand what those things really are. I'm like, oh man, it's yet another thing. And they don't do a good job of explaining it. I mean, someone asked me the other day, what's Bitcoin? And I'm all, oh man, you know, I should know the answer to that. I don't think there's, again, this is a general problem for all entrepreneurs. And this is a reason why I wanted to talk with you about this, because your unique perspective on it is a valuable lesson for anyone in any industry, not just fintech, but any entrepreneur that wants to have his company have the potential for success. And so broadly, other than the why and the deep dive into that, what other parts of the process allow you to transform? And I'm saying, I think transform's the word, because it really is a transformation. When people get their story straight and they can tell it quickly and they feel it, people feel that. Like there's this hidden thing among humans. I don't know what it is, but when we hear a good story and we hear like someone speaking truth, for whatever reason, we just get attracted to it. And so I'm curious, what's after the kind of the why process? How do you go about doing the rest of it?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So, you know, af- after the why process and you really going through the deeply introspective early stages of this journey, you know, the next thing is exactly that. It's translating that into the specificity of knowing that seeing yourself as an agent of change and then knowing in a very, very clear and crisp way what that change is and what it means in the world, that gives you the ability to distill that down into a set of clear and crisp messages. And those messages in turn can be, you know, some people think story first and then the message comes after, kind of like an Aesop's fable. And some people think messages first and they plan things top down and then they plug in the stories there. And oddly enough, some of those French authors that we were talking about earlier, or they're taking that top down approach where they have this big idea about the world and then they're writing multiple novels in order to illustrate different facets of that idea. But, you know, regardless, that, you know, you were asking about the kind of the transformation process. It's from the why to what that why means in the world, and then being able to get to this point of seeing the messages and the stories that support and communicate that why. So, because if you want that change to happen, it can't just happen in your room, in your office, wherever you're working. It has to happen in the world.
Yeah. Yeah. It has to be like a meme.
Yeah. And it has to be, you know, in order to do that, you have to learn how to translate your private language into a public language.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I always say you got to be able to explain it to your grandmother, and a lot of people have a hard time with that. Because
yeah, and, you know, there's another element of it too, which is, you know, you mentioned that, you know, it's really hard to explain what Bitcoin is. Why is that when it's not really hard to explain what a credit card is or a credit card transaction? And I'll tell you, once you really dig beneath the surface, that is so much more complicated than a token that's registered on the blockchain. It's so much more complicated. But no one has the slightest problem understanding it because they understand it at the level that's meaningful for them, which is, oh, cool, I just got my groceries, or whatever it else is. I just ordered this book on Amazon, or whatever I did. All the stuff that happens underneath the surface there is more complex than, I would say, you know, 99.9%+ of the population really understands. Yet it still works, and it still matters to them that they're able to buy something without having to have cash in hand.
Yeah, I really like that point about make it meaningful for them. I think that is absolutely lost on most people. It's really a question of, okay, so when you communicate, this is what you said, say something, right? Mm-hmm. But you also have to understand, okay, what do people hear? And I love what you said about, and why does it, what makes it meaningful for them? So the credit card one's a great example. Everyone uses a credit card. So at some point, even if it was complex, they do know the most basic thing. I don't have to carry cash. I tap my card, I get my groceries, right? Amazon, one click. The technology behind all that could be super complicated, but it's pretty easy. Oh, I like something, I hit click.
Right.
And I think with Bitcoin and the blockchain and crypto and all this other stuff, I don't think enough people use it yet for it to have that kind of meme or meme type of repeatability or making it meaningful to them. I mean, I know like now you can buy a Tesla with Bitcoin as an example. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, now people are like, well, what is this? Like, oh, I can buy a car with it. Interesting. Like, you know, back in the day, I think it was 5-6 years ago, someone bought a pizza with Bitcoin,
right?
But it's in that pizza is now worth, I don't know, $100 million.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, right. Yeah. That's some crazy thing. Right. How is it more difficult when it's not like a common thing? Like, you know, crypto right now is not a common thing. Some fintech stuff, not very common. Is it a lot harder for that message to get through and to kind of, and I always think about it like either crossing the chasm or jumping the gap, or you know, making it go viral, or, you know, building the meme, you know, like, it seems that there is a bit of a barrier when it's not as common as, you know, everyone knows like what a podcast is, or when back in the day, no one did, but it's sort of becoming main. How do you make that transition from niche to then thought leader in niche, and then thought leader in the mainstream?
Yeah. You know, that's a really interesting question to me, because, you know, in all of these different scenarios, if you compare the scenarios that seem to be easier to understand, like a podcast or a credit card, they've already found their analog, or they grew out of their analog. And what I mean by that is, you know, pretty much everyone had already experienced a radio show or a talk show on TV, and they had experienced the internet. It kind of like the podcast was an easy one to do, because the use cases pre-existed it. And similar with credit card, you know, prior to that, there was cash. And prior to that, there were, you know, you start thinking like, well, what's the long history of how a transaction could happen, you know, versus just two people trading one thing for another and putting gold as an intermediary between it, and then, you know, actual coinage of that precious metal, and then translating that to paper money, and then translating that to plastic money, and then having it be digital. There's this sort of natural evolution, and the use cases precede the innovation. Bitcoin is kind of a different animal, because the use cases don't quite precede the innovation, and people are kind of bouncing around trying to figure out, well, you know, does that mean, is it a store of value? Is it an asset to invest in? Is it, you know, just another currency but different? That I don't think has been resolved. And, you know, it may ultimately not resolve itself in the form of Bitcoin. It may be some future iteration of, you know, a cryptocurrency or a digital asset as people try to figure out what to do with it.
Yeah, it's almost like a technology looking for a problem to solve, almost.
Yeah, in some ways.
I mean, I think AI is like that too. You know, I have a lot of buddies that are doing AI type stuff, and everyone wants to be an AI. Everyone, I don't know if most people even really understand what it is. And I read this one tweet the other day. It was pretty funny. This guy's like, I think I've got more AI in my name than most companies have in their whole portfolio. And he happened to have the letters AI in his name, obviously. So, you know, right. Being right. A bit sarcastic that way. But I wonder, I mean, and also that's a really interesting way how you kind of went through the process of exchange, which I think is a very valuable thing. You know, we used to barter, then we had coinage, then we had paper money, you know, now we have electronic transfer, you know, you buy something, you can wire money. Now we've got different platforms like Venmo and all these other things where we can kind of exchange between, you know, we can give money to each other without going through a quote unquote bank it's an intermediary, but not in the sense of like a bank. And then I think, you know, Bitcoin is probably the most direct transaction, you know, direct digital transaction where you don't need, it's a, you know, decentralized, you don't need anyone to be the intermediary. And then right. No one's really like, I don't think anyone's quite figured out, well, why is that important? You know, really, does anyone really care? I think people will care, and you can see that in its value and its fluctuation. And then you can see, of course, all the other technologies and stuff, like, you know, all the platforms to do investment, as an example, like Robinhood and, you know, the whole GameStop fiasco,
right.
And stuff like that, where it's like this, you can sort of see the little bit of the inner workings of the financial system and how rigged it is. It can be. I mean, you know, it's not totally rigged, but boy, when a bunch of folks on Reddit can manipulate one stock and keep on doing it, something's not right in the world. And I think that's what some of these, you know, fintech entrepreneurs are trying to solve. I mean, this, you know, almost the democratization of transactions, but it's still complex, right? I mean, it must be sometimes frustrating to try to figure this out, because, you know, my guess is intellectually, you know, it's a very stimulating thing. I mean, I love nothing more than to get a client of mine and they say, hey, how do we tell better stories? And I dig into what they do, similar to what you do. Like, how do I parse this out? And the intellectual exercise is just fascinating to me. So do you see, like, in your work with this fintech stuff, I mean, are there starting to get momentum around thought leadership and certain people that are actually explaining this well and actually, like, you know, who either your clients or people that you know? Because my guess is that's when, once people start explaining it, you know, to their grandmother and they can understand it, that's when it tips, you know, for the
right
tipping point.
Right. No, that's certainly true for anything where mass adoption is part of the equation. You know, in a business to consumer world, where, you know, mass adoption makes sense. You know, I was thinking a little bit too about this parallel to another scenario where the use case didn't really exist until the technology started to create it, and that would be around social networking. So, you know, and there were a bunch of false starts in the social networking world. There was, you know, all these things that people kind of laugh about. If, you know, at least if you're of a certain age and generation, you
yeah,
you
AOL laugh about your, and CompuServe,
yeah, your AOL and CompuServe, and then you laugh about, you know, like your MySpace page. And
which
your
still has
profile,
like,
and all these
still,
things.
Yeah, it's MySpace still has millions of hits a month. It's, I yeah, mean,
I don't understand that one at all.
But. Well, but you know what? But you're right. Like, oh, this is really good. Yeah, no, you're interesting. Yeah, yeah.
But it took
media.
A while for the use cases around it to gel and then become commercialized and monetized. And, you know, that's a whole other minefield of tricky issues to talk about, but the point being is that, you know, that may ultimately be where we are right now in the world of crypto. Is, you know, we're still in the world of, you know, like the AOLs or maybe the MySpaces, and you know, maybe Coinbase is the MySpace of crypto. I don't know.
It's a good way to put it, though, because I mean, I think, you know, your whole point about commercialize and monetize is the same with, like, search as an example. I think that's another technology where, you know, a Google search, I mean, that kind of never existed until the technology was there. Although the process of searching for things, you know, back in the day, you'd have the card catalog at the library, thumb through it, you'd have, you know, whatever, books or whatever, but never before had all this information been kind of put together and indexable and searchable. I mean, and they were, you know, old time private databases like LexisNexis and all that sort of stuff that costs a tremendous amount of money to access. So I think the interesting thing with that is that, yeah, that there was sort of the use case for it, although no one figured out, my guess is no one really thought, well, yeah, everyone on the planet would want to search something in Google. And I'm curious, what are your thoughts on that type of approach to thought leadership? Because, you know, there's a huge debate now. I don't remember who did it. Was it Ernst & Young? They just did a study about ads. And they kind of like figured out, they're trying to figure out where all the ad money goes.
Right.
And it was like, I think over half the ad money doesn't go to the actual ad or provider. It goes to all these third parties. And it's actually a really complicated mess. And it's even worse than that, because some of it, like I think 15% of it, they're like, we have no idea where this goes. And I know a lot of people's strategy for getting on top of mind is through SEO, right? You know, search engine optimization.
Yep.
And so I'm curious, how does that fit into all this? And is it just like another ad kind of, I don't want to say hoax, because I'm not a fan of ads, just full stop, but talk me through a little bit about that. Cause my guess is there's a strategy behind, okay, now we've got everyone aligned. You're going to be a thought leader. Now, how do we get the word out?
Yeah. You know, that's the role of SEO in thought leadership is, certainly a complex issue. I want to be clear that, you know, because of the types of companies that I work with, and, you know, it's fintech, and I'm very much within the context of institutional fintech. So, you know, it's banks that are offering services and products to other banks, or fintechs that are offering services to other banks or investment managers. And I point that out because this is a world, and somewhat unique to this world, although there's lots of others as parallel, where if you're a fintech and you can reach, let's say there's going to be 1,000, maybe even fewer decision makers that actually matter to your business, right? It's heads of hedge funds and bank CEOs and, you know, other C-level folks within top banks. Those are the people that are going to transform your business, and getting your thought leadership to those people, who, by the way, probably aren't spending a lot of time poking around doing Google searches to find the solution for what's going to run their hedge fund or what's going to enable them to process trillions of dollars of payments more easily. No one's buying that through Google. I'll tell you that. And
yeah, no, you're true. Totally true.
It really means that, you know, thought leadership, we talked a lot about the what and the why, didn't really get so much into the who. And what I like about the question of SEO is that that really is a question of, well, not only just having that story out there, like you've printed it on a bunch of cards and you're throwing it off the deck of the Empire State Building so everyone in New York can see it, but really a very hyper-targeted approach to getting that thought leadership into the hands of the people who, you know, ultimately you are trying to lead with your thinking. And when you look at it in those terms, when you're not looking for mass appeal, because people aren't buying a widget, but it's, you know, major companies making very high stakes decisions that can ultimately impact whether or not they're able to function as a business. Google's kind of it's a tricky phenomenon, because it's unlikely that those decision makers are using that tool to inform their decisions. Yeah. So you really need a very different strategy for getting your content into those hands. And sometimes what happens too is people try to focus on solving the SEO, you know, the optimization piece of the puzzle, and they end up cheapening or damaging their content. I've seen companies do this where they get into this mode of chasing keywords and chasing their Google metrics. Oh my God, yeah. We have to fix our domain ranking. We have to do this and we have to do that. Yeah. And they really, really lose sight of the actual situation that they're trying to address, which is to, you know, to lead the market in a certain direction and to attract, you know, high stakes decision makers.
Yeah, I think it's all about, great point. I think it's all about who you're trying to get at. And I'm glad you brought up that, you know, it really is contextual. I mean, you know, if you're going for mass broad appeal, then maybe an SEO strategy works. But I like I like how you brought up cheapening the message. I never thought about it that way. I never thought about how mass appeal could cheapen and or reduce your credibility, so to speak. I mean, I don't know kind of how that would work in this context, but I find it interesting that, like, in fintech decision makers that you work with, right, the kind of B2B kind of folks, there's maybe 1,000 people in the world that could make a decision for your company. Right. Yeah, you need to go find out where they are, target them. And I think it's almost making it a little bit more like premium or cachet. Or I don't know. I sometimes get or have friends that kind of show me these newsletters, these financial newsletters. I'm sure you've heard of them, where, like, this is how you invest in crypto, or this is how you invest in the stock market. I mean, the most kind of famous broad appeal one is like the Motley Fool is an example.
Right, right.
My guess is the CEO of Goldman Sachs, when it was around, or if it still is, I don't even know, or
no, it is.
JP Morgan Chase, right?
Right, right.
Probably not reading the Motley Fool. I mean, maybe they get bubbled up some brief, but yeah, like, what are those bank presidents, what are those CEOs of major financial institutions, like, what do they read? And if you've got to target them, then yeah, I mean, good point. Like making that a kind of a quote unquote premium offer, or at least a in the know insider kind of thing, which sounds, you know, elitist. Okay. I grant you that, but yeah, you got to find your audience, I guess, for your message.
Yeah. You have to find your audience, and you know, you only have, there's only so much time and effort and energy and resources available to you. What's the better investment of all that time and effort? Is it just boosting some traffic numbers so the next time someone logs into Google Analytics, they look at some numbers? Or is it putting those things into the hands of the most relevant decision makers? You know, because those numbers, you don't know anything about those numbers. Those numbers, they're not decision makers. There's not buyers. You can make some inferences about them, but you know, I would rather. When I post a blog post, I couldn't care less about whether it matches someone's search queries, whether it's keyword optimized. It certainly has to be readable and well-structured and logical. But if I can get that blog post into the hands of three decision makers that will remember me, and I'm a small business, so I can say three, but who will remember me and do business with me 6 months later, having 1,000, 10,000, 50,000 hits on that blog post is absolutely meaningless. Yeah. And that's why it doesn't make sense to optimize it for these search queries, because I really don't care what people are searching for. And I think that's really a very relevant model for my clients as well. It doesn't really matter who is searching for information about the implications of interest rate resets on, you know, these bundled securitized loans. Who cares who searches for that? The people that own those loan portfolios. Those are the people you need that content in the hands of.
Yeah. Well, this is the same premise when it comes to PR and marketing that I always hear from startups and entrepreneurs and clients. Oh, I want to get into the big tier one media. I hear this all the time. And how do I get into TechCrunch is usually the first question.
Right.
And I'm like, well, do you really need to be in TechCrunch, or is that just a vanity metric? Because a lot of this stuff is vanity metrics, to be honest. And I'm glad you brought this up, because in terms of even social media follows, even, you know, organic search results, and even ads, like paying for eyeballs, very nefarious, honestly.
Yeah.
Because you never know what those clicks are. I mean, they're all, in my mind, just vanity metrics. And they're actually all bad story tags in one sense. I mean, I disagree to a certain degree about SEO, but I see your point. Because the most important thing you can do in any communications, know your audience and go talk to them. And if that's 10 people that are going to potentially do business with you in the future, then the 100 million people that may read it are insignificant. And I really glad you brought this point up, because I think for new entrepreneurs and just generally entrepreneurs, knowing your audience and really being specific on your audience and not just spraying and praying is the thing that really gets people down the path of wasting money on a launch, wasting money on media, frankly, wasting money on a PR firm that's not going to help you. You know, I think it's a really important thing to really understand who you want to target with any communications. I mean, partly why I do this podcast, honestly, is I'm targeting entrepreneurs. Like, people that listen to this podcast should also want to pick my book up and learn how to be a better entrepreneur. So
sure, yeah,
it's super interesting. Like, I never thought about it that way. I like that.
And, you know, I think sometimes I think about SEO, and it's not just the individual piece of content, but you know, when you're doing that, you're always in an arms race, right? Because if your company becomes hyper focused on SEO and your competitors are hyper focused on SEO, it's this ridiculous arms race. And I kind of have this thought that it's like the old world of the yellow pages, where it was always the joke of, like, you know, which plumber do you pick? Like, you start off and Advantage Plumbing is like, oh, we're the first listing, and then Aardvark Plumbing comes along, you're like, damn it, now we're not the first listing anymore.
Yeah.
So Advantage Plumbing changes its name to AAA Advantage Plumbing.
Regis McKenna.
Changes its name to AAA. Yeah,
this is because of Regis McKenna. Does everyone know? Look up Regis McKenna.
No, I don't know what this is.
Oh, No, this is it. So Regis McKenna is a marketing, I mean, back in the day, he was originally like Apple. He was the original Apple guy or a consultant. And his rule was be first in the phone book.
Right.
That was one of his rules. So always start with an A, right? Or whatever, right? But it's funny.
But that's the thing. But you don't own that algorithm and you don't control it. So then when the Yellow Pages company decides that, okay, we're doing display ads now. What happened to your first in the phone book listing?
Yeah.
And then what I always think, and I was, when I use this story, I always compare it. So we've talked about Aardvark and Advantage Plumbing. I want my clients and I want my own company to be, I mean, I call it Martin Plumbing, right? Because it's in the middle of the listing. And, you know, Martin Plumbing is the one that's like, has all the great relationships with, you know, with people of influence in the town. And the people that like to talk about their home improvement projects and knows everything about the latest fixtures and talks about them. And the Martin Plumbing is the one that gets all the business for like the major remodels and renovations and big sticky problems. And Aardvark Plumbing, there's a problem with my sink. I call you once and then I go away and that's the end of it.
Right. No, you're right. I mean, I love the arms race analogy because it's like, I think Google... In May, we're recording this in the end of April. I think in May they're going to change their search algorithm.
Yep,
and I remember
right.
the last.
And then the whole.
Yeah, then everything goes kind of resets. I remember when this happened a while back, and it was Jason Calcanis had a company. I think it was called Ohana, and it was basically like building links. It was like they would curate links and then put it on a page,
right.
And you know,
right.
And literally Google changed the algo and 85% of their traffic just blip, went away, gone, poof.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, now he's working on, well, he invested in this thing called Inside, which is all these newsletters. And so he's taking it to like, oh, I want to directly connect to a customer. Therefore, I want to give them to give me my email so I know who they are. And I think that's the ultimate, almost ultimate currency now. It's, yes, you have to get discovered and it's hard when you first started out. Granted, you know, don't get me wrong. You probably have to run some ads or do some organic SEO, whatever. Like you got to find who your customer is, but boy, you're totally right. Change the algo, everything goes away. You really need to really build a customer. You need to get to know the customer and be intimate with them and know who they are and service them. So.
Yeah, no, and I'm just inherently suspicious of processes that only exist to perpetuate themselves. And
yeah, that's true.
SEO is a really great example of
good point.
You know, it's always an arms race. The algorithm is always changing. There's this whole ecosystem of SEO specialists. When I'm being especially snarky, I'll say that SEO stands for screw everyone over.
All right, I'm with you. Okay.
And that's why, you know, and it's not that I dismiss the value of, like, you know, like you're saying with ads, there are situations where it makes sense, but that can't be your strategy. And the sad thing that happens is people lose sight of it and then it becomes their strategy. You know, and if your strategy is bottom feeding, what is it that you're going to be eating?
Yeah.
It's not nice. Whatever it is, it's
no,
not nice.
True. So what advice would you give the next generation of entrepreneurs coming up?
Yeah, I love that question because, you know, I really been around for a bit and I see multiple generations of people coming up and it ties back to what I was saying earlier about, you know, building a business is hard. Creating a product is hard. There's so many problems that you always trying to solve because, you know, you're trying to get there. But the biggest piece of advice is, don't lose sight of the why. In fact, keep going on that why and keep pushing yourself. Ask, why does this matter? Why does this matter? Because the more connected to that you are, the more fuel you have for your own passion. But even at a more outward looking level, the more fuel you have for your messaging and the way you get yourself out into the world.
Wow. Yeah, I agree. Have a strong why. Keep on keeping on with that. So Chris.
Yeah. And don't let it sit. Keep digging.
Yeah.
Keep digging. I'm still, you know, I've been at this for many, many years and I still keep digging down. And, you know, what is it that I mean? And what is this when I talk about all these things about ethical content and, you know, the ecological approach to human attention? And, you know, that's the real meaning of thought leadership, right? Is having courtesy toward people's attention and their time because of all the messages that are out there in the world. That's my latest level of depth, but I'm still going to keep digging down. And so, just that why really, really fuels what I do next and how I evolve my business. And I think that matters for a new entrepreneur as well.
Yeah, I agree. Chris, thank you so much for being on the show. Really, really appreciate it. And definitely going to go check out some French literature now.
Yeah, no, I'll share a couple of specifics and some specific titles. You can put them in the show notes as well for other people to take a look.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Thanks again. Stay safe.
Yeah, thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Christopher, for being on the show. I learned a ton, and I'm so glad you gave us some awesome books to get started on our French literature book club. That was really cool, so I appreciate that. Now, as promised, here are some actionable insights I learned from my interview with Christopher. Your why is your fuel. Keep asking yourself why, even after several years. This will help drive you and keep you motivated and passionate. Chris does this for himself as well as for his clients. SEO and ads can be a solid starting point, but eventually you're going to want to focus on who you are reaching, not how many people you are reaching. And everyone that listens to this show knows my somewhat disdain for digital ads and the spray and pray method. So know your audience and talk directly to them. Don't be afraid to learn new things, even when they are far afield from what you've studied in school or did in a past career. Learning is an important part of seeing the gaps in your own thinking, and I can't stress this enough. Make sure that you're always trying to learn something new and keep your mind sharp and try to figure out where the crossover is for different things that may seem completely independent from each other. Well, there you go. That's what I learned from Christopher. So thanks for listening, and we'll see you next episode. Thanks for listening to the Entrepreneur Ethos podcast. I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I did creating it. My hope is that you learned something that can make you a little bit better. If you enjoyed the podcast, please do share it with friends and review it on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. You can also join my email list by visiting theentrepreneurethos.com to get my thoughts on what I'm doing to get better, as well as what I'm working on. You can also pick up my book, The Entrepreneur Ethos, if you want to learn the traits, values, and beliefs that I think we need to build a more ethical, inclusive, and resilient entrepreneur, and frankly, world community. Feel free to follow me on Twitter at The Daily MBA and let me know if you have any questions or recommendations for a guest you'd like me to talk to. Also, drop me a note if you try anything we talked about on this or any other episode. I'd love to hear what's working for you. Until next time, keep getting better.